Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution for the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us this week is Jesse McKinley, the Albany Bureau Chief of the New York Times. Welcome, Jesse.
How are you?
Okay, so I got a whole bunch of questions for you. There's been sort of a switch in the way in which Andrew Cuomo has been looking politically. I think it's fair to say he's been tacking to the left. What's that all about?
I think that's a fair characterization, and I don't think this is necessarily a new thing. I think the second term, which he was elected to in 2014, has been kind of marked by a fairly consistent adoption of kind of more left-wing policies. And I think part of that came out of the primary challenge that he had in September 2014 when Zephyr Teachout gave him a pretty good run for his money, considering she herself had no money, you know. I think that scared him straight in a little bit in terms of liberal policies. And I think he's also kind of reckoning with a kind of national political moment in which, you know, the most popular Democratic politician out there right now is Bernie Sanders. And Bernie Sanders is a socialist. And I think when you start to listen to voters in your party, in the Democratic Party, of which he is a member, they want policies that more closely reflect kind of the Bernie Sanders wing of that party versus the, you know, the more centrist portion that he's always been a part of.
So it was no mistake that we saw when he advanced his everybody under $125,000 gets to go to college, so it's a SUNY free. He had Bernie Sanders standing there with him.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's interesting when you look just at the political optics there, right? Because he introduced it with Bernie Sanders, and when it actually got passed and became law, he was standing next to Hillary Clinton. I don't think that was an accident. You know, I think that that was a way to kind of bookend his political spectrum, you know, that he can play with the left, but then he can also play with perhaps the most well-known Democrat, Hillary Clinton. And that gives him, you know, that range of voters that potentially, you know, if you start to read the tea leaves, could be important to him if he decided to run in 2020.
Well, is his staff different, Jesse? Is his staff different from the way in which he was running things for a while? I mean, he was surrounded by some people who turn out to be bums. And is that a bad characterization?
Well, I think at this point we have to call them alleged bums.
Oh, yes, alleged bums. I take it back. At least one of them has already admitted culpability and his guilt and is cooperating with the federal authorities. Does that have any permanence? Does that hurt him?
Well, a couple of things there. There's a lot to unpack. But yes, I mean, I think in terms of his staffing in the second term, you have obviously seen turnover. You've seen kind of more veteran people that may have even worked for his father or may have worked for previous administrations, you know, people like Larry Schwartz and Howard Glazer and people that came up with him, kind of leave the administration, sometimes by their own choice. And in the case of Joe Prococo, who I think you're mentioning, you know, is under federal indictment, not by their own volition, kind of forced out because of their legal troubles. But that being said, you know, with Prococo's trial coming up, you know, it looks like it's probably going to get started, you know, late fall this year. It could cause political problems for him because he's up for re-election next year. And let's say that that federal trial drags on for 3 months or 6 months or you know, gets pushed into his election year. Then you've got his closest aide from his first term, Joe Prococo, a man who he has referred to as a member of his family, on trial, potentially even on the stand, on a federal corruption trial. And that's impossible to run away from. You know, that is something that any Republican candidate worth their salt will hammer him on day after day after day. And that could become kind of a fairly significant political liability. You know, in talking to people in the Capitol, I think the general sense is this could be the calm before the storm, that, you know, he's been doing quite well politically. And I think his approval ratings are running pretty high. And the ship that he has assembled seems to be sailing pretty smoothly right now. But this Prococo trial in the fall and potentially next year could be a real storm for him.
Now, Chris Christie, of course, has been damaged beyond all recognition. You couldn't put that Humpty Dumpty back together again. And he's got to have his eye on that. But as an ancillary part of this multi-part question, he has just hired Chris Christie's top person to be his number two in his operation. What do we take away from that?
Yeah, Maria Camilla, who is, I think, 36. She's considered very bright, very pugnacious. She was just hired as chief of staff. And I think that, once again, is one of these moves that may signal kind of an embrace of potential national ambitions. Now, of course, he disavows this. He says he only wants to run the state of New York, and the only thing he's running for is re-election next year.
Yeah, well, that's a lot of baloney. We all know it.
I'll say that's alleged baloney, but see that as a But the point of it is that Maria Camilla has run several, or been involved in at least several, Republican national political campaigns. I mean, she worked on W's campaign in 2004. She worked on McCain, Palin in 2008, and she worked on Christie's very, very no good, bad campaign in 2016. Now you could argue, hey, listen, those are three out of four losers, but still, she has the kind of chops and the kind of understanding of the way things play on a political stage nationally that you could imagine Andrew Cuomo kind of being interested in and wanting to have that perspective, particularly as a centrist Democrat who is going to want to play big in, you know, swing states.
You know, you said something, Jesse McKinley, that I thought was very interesting, and that was that, you know, his numbers were pretty good right now, and they are.
Mm-hmm.
I attribute that to, number one, to the fact that his name is still Cuomo, and that's important to Democrats, but also to the fact that he's doing some things which are a little bit more to the left and popular, but I can't find anybody who likes him. Do you know the difference? I mean, the difference is when you take the people on Long Island in New York City and say, what do you think of him? Is he doing a good job? Yeah, because they don't know anything about New York State. But when I talk to the insiders, they don't like him.
Yeah, I mean, I once wrote, and I'm not trying to pat myself on the back, but I thought it was a pretty decent line where I said he's kind of the Willie Loman of politics. You know, he's liked, but he's not well-liked. And I think that particularly that is true amongst political insiders who, you know, Andrew Cuomo is known as a very savvy politician. He's known as a guy who can see around corners politically. You know, he's no dummy, but he has also made a few enemies along the way. You know, he has been active in Albany politics for three decades, and he has rubbed a lot of people the wrong way along that route. And, you know, that includes former staffers, that includes people who have worked for other politicians. So it's not surprising to me that, you know, people aren't exactly, you know, thrilled by him all the time. But in terms of, like, voters, I think what's interesting about him is that he kind of is winning right now by default, by just not screwing up to an extent. You know, he's been pretty successful, as you mentioned, with some of the more liberal policies that he's unveiled. But by the same token, he hasn't had any major, you know, political scandals, you know, other than the Prococo thing, which is still kind of on a low simmer right now, that have really knocked him off his game recently. I mean, you can argue that the Moreland Commission a couple years ago was certainly not a high watermark for him. But he hasn't had anything, you know, you mentioned Chris Christie before, he hasn't had anything on the level of a Bridgegate that has really destroyed his reputation. And by, you know, by the transitive property, he is doing pretty well because he hasn't done badly, you know.
Yeah, yeah. So you raise the next question. As I say to Ed Cox all the time when he's telling me they're going to beat Cuomo in the election, I say, okay, who you got? Who you got?
Yeah.
Bring it. And he mentions some guy with a radio show in New York and something else. And, I say, oh, come on, that's the same old, what do you got? And likewise, 2018 coming up when he has to run for governor for the third time, always a tough election. Is there anybody who might run against him in the Democratic Party? Would Zephyr ever do it again?
Yeah, I would find that unlikely. I think Zephyr ran for Congress last year. She didn't win, but she probably has other plans in mind. I think actually her campaign in 2014 was almost a protest campaign. It was almost an effort to catch his attention, and I think it worked. I think it absolutely caught his attention because she got, you know, 33, 34% of the vote without even, really a penny in the bank. But in terms of Democratic challengers in a primary, I would find that exceedingly unlikely, simply because, A, his popularity, B, he's got a war chest. You know, the guy's walking around with $25 million in his reelection campaign. You know, that buys a lot of flyers and a lot of radio and television in small markets up and down the state. So in terms of Democratic challengers, I think it's a little bit of a long shot. And equally, I'm not exactly sure what the GOP is going to come up with. You know, there had been some rumblings that maybe Astorino would give it another shot. There had been some talk that Collins might be getting, or rather Gibson might be getting.
From Buffalo, yeah, go ahead.
Collins from Buffalo has a longstanding feud with Cuomo, and Chris Gibson from the Hudson Valley, who is kind of more of a moderate Republican, had been kind of rumored to have some gubernatorial ambitions. But you haven't really seen the ground game there. You haven't seen, you know, the speaking engagements and the fiery speeches and the, you know, pleading to the Republican base that you might sort of kind of expect to see at this stage in the game. I mean, it's still early. We're still, you know, what is it, 18 months out from the election. But you haven't really seen that sort of saber rattling that a potential candidate would probably be engaged in at this point. But, you know, once again, it's a long way off.
Now, Jesse McKinley of the New York Times, I guess I got to ask you this. In New York, there's a big political battle. It's clear by now, no matter what the denials, that Mayor de Blasio and Andrew Cuomo hate each other's guts. Wouldn't there be a possibility that de Blasio, behind the scenes, it wouldn't be the first time, tries to get somebody up there to run against them?
Allegedly hates each other's guts, Alan, one more time. But I think what...
I'll stay with what I got. Go ahead. Yeah.
I think the situation there actually might be reversed. I think that, you know, the whispers I've heard is that Cuomo wouldn't necessarily mind a Democratic challenger to Bill de Blasio, who, of course, is up for re-election this year, if only to kind of scruff up his downstate rival a little bit. I'm less attuned to what's going on inside of Gracie Mansion, inside of City Hall. But, there is definitely a rivalry there. There is, you know, there's, I don't know if they're frenemies or what the other word would be, but, you know, they definitely don't necessarily get along. They seem to oftentimes, particularly Cuomo, seems to either delicately or indelicately kind of sabotage efforts by de Blasio in Albany. You know, one of the kind of lingering issues that we'll be looking at in the next couple of months during the end of the legislative session is this question of mayoral control of the schools, which Bill de Blasio has just been absolutely tortured by during his time in office. He'd initially wanted 3 years or 7 years, I think, of control, or indefinite control even of the New York City schools. And in Albany, with a Republican Senate, they've got him down to coming up every year for 1 year extensions. And I think that is humbling or even humiliating for Bill de Blasio. And while Cuomo has given kind of lip service to extending that to 3 years, you know, there hasn't been a lot of political oomph behind that. And I think that's just one of a number of examples of Cuomo kind of stepping on de Blasio or showing, conceivably who's boss. And that dynamic continues to this day. You know, I don't think there's any love lost between those two administrations at all.
So I guess I got to ask you this because you've mentioned the Senate word at one point. The New York State Senate is one of the more interesting things. Now, I'm going to say something and you're going to come back and say allegedly. So so here it is. It's clear to me that Andrew Cuomo has always wanted a Republican Senate, just like his papa Mario, who I had a show with for, 18 years. You know, they say one thing, but in effect, they get along for whatever reason better with the Republicans. Now, it's getting so close. You got blue state New York. You got gerrymandered districts in the Senate. Are we coming to a resolution where the Democrats take over the New York State Senate?
I would have bet last fall, and I would have been wrong about pretty much everything I bet on last fall, but I would have bet last fall that the Democrats would have had a much better year in the state Senate and probably would have taken an outright majority. I was completely wrong, and I admit that fully. But, you know, I think that there is this will be the continued, when does the levee break there? you know, for years, the Democrats have hoped to kind of switch, particularly those seats on Long Island, where they seem to hold kind of a slight demographic advantage in terms of Democratic Party registration in those districts, those kind of 1 through 9 districts out on Long Island. And they've started to make some inroads there. You know, they got Todd Kominski elected last year. John Brooks kind of won that very close race against Michael Vendetto after his father got indicted. You know, there appear to be some cracks where the Democrats seem to be making headway on Long Island. By the same token, you know, they've lost races in the Hudson Valley. A large swath of upstate New York continue to be solidly conservative. So, you know, it's an ongoing betting game as to when the Democrats might have that kind of swell where they win, you know, they win big and they pick up 3, 4, or 5 seats, which would then make this situation, and you haven't mentioned the independent Democratic.
I was about to, Jesse, because I knew you would say allegedly, but their name is, I've given them the name the Traitors. Because, you know, they pull the rug out from under the Democrats. They've negotiated with the Senate, I believe, with the absolute understanding that the governor wasn't killing them for doing it. Is there any chance? I mean, let's say the Republicans actually lose a seat or two. What makes you think that the independent, so-called breakaway Democrats or the traitors won't stay with the Republicans?
Well, once again, your nomenclature, not mine. But
yes,
but
that's correct. That's right.
Yeah, in terms of the IDC, I think the unspoken problem there, and some people do speak it, and I've reported out a little bit of this. You know, the unspoken problem is basically that the Independent Democratic Conference, which is led by Jeff Klein, and the, you know, kind of mainstream, for lack of a better word, Democratic Conference led by Andrea Stewart Cousins and seconded by Michael Gennaris of Queens, those two parties don't like each other. And I think when you use the word traitor, you know, that is something that I think that the, you know, Andrea Stewart Cousins and Michael Gennaris's camp, I think they feel that way about the IDC, and I think there's a lot of bad blood there. And so the question becomes, even if the Democrats were to win enough seats where, you know, they would have a, you know, seemingly, you know, indisputable numeric majority, would you be able to get those two rival factions of Democrats to sit down at a table and you know, play nice? And I'm very unconvinced that could happen. You know, I think that particularly next year, when you start to see, you know, perhaps primary challenges of IDC members, where you start to see an active effort by mainstream Democrats to knock off independent Democrats, I think that sort of political battle, you know, it opens new wounds and infects old wounds, and it just becomes increasingly unpleasant situation for Senate Democrats. And I don't really know how that resolves itself, short of, you know, a incredible landslide victory for Democratic candidates, where they suddenly pick up 6, 8 seats, and where it's just there's no way they can't get back together and take a majority position. But right now, the Republicans have played this remarkably smart. You know, they've got the majority without actually having the members because of this arrangement with the IDC. And voters have started to pay attention. You know, particularly with the election of Trump, you know, that has given the mainstream Democrats a kind of a cudgel to beat the IDC over the head with, saying, oh, well, you're collaborating with Donald Trump and Donald Trump and Donald Trump. And that, of course, drives the IDC crazy, but it's a pretty effective political tool, you know, because it really does link them with a Republican president who is not popular in big portions of, you know, New York City and a lot of liberal areas in the state.
Do you think? However, there are two ways that things could really change. Number one, if the Supreme Court ever takes up the issue of the gerrymander, which Felix Frankfurter once said, we have to stay out of the political thicket, the Supreme Court. If they do, and they say, this is not democratic, this business of you, the winners draw their own districts and keep themselves in office for perpetuity, or, I'll give you another one on my menu, or Andrew Cuomo calls the IDC into the room, knowing that it's going south for them because of what you've just said about Trump and all the rest, and says, look, boys, get back where you belong. Does he have that kind of power?
Yeah, I think that, you know, one of Cuomo's kind of gifts if you like him, it's a gift. If you don't like him, it's a curse. I mean, he is good at getting people to do what he wants them to do. And I think, you know, he is, as I mentioned before, pretty popular right now. And I think he is in a kind of commanding position in terms of Democratic politics in the state. But as you mentioned before, I'm not sure he wants to do that. You know, the bulwark of the IDC and the Republican majority in the Senate really prevents him from having to adopt or, you know, confront much more liberal policies that are being voted on right. and passed again and again by the Assembly. And, you know, this includes, you know, things as ranged as, you know, the DREAM Act and ethics reform and stuff like that, things that he may not want to deal with or may not kind of fit into his long-term plans or may not just fit into his short-term plans. You know, the Republican Senate allows him to kind of bat those back and put them off and say, well, we can't get it through the Senate, so we're not going to do it, and gives him a little bit of political cover for not really embracing more liberal progressive policies.
I could not agree with you more about what you've just said. So now, I guess the question is, will we ever see ethical reform in New York? I'm convinced if Andrew Cuomo really wanted it, we would have really gotten it. But, you know, he made the right moves. He said, I tried. They didn't go for it. But I don't think he wanted it any more than they did.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that there is a school of thought that is absolutely true. And without drawing too fine of a point on it, things like the LLC loophole, which is a bugaboo for a lot of liberal groups, and that's a mechanism by which you can set up, you know, limited liability companies and basically funnel almost unlimited amounts of money to political candidates. That loophole has been used by Andrew Cuomo.
Exactly.
I mean, that has been a very effective way of him raising money. So, you know, the cynical political analysis will be, well, he's not going to close something that helps him out politically and helps him out in terms of fundraising. They'll counter once again, well, we've put out all these proposals and we want all this stuff and we can't get it through the Republican Senate and bah, bah, bah. But, you know, I think your analysis is not completely incorrect in that he, if he really wanted some of this stuff, he could probably maybe push a little bit harder for it. You know, he mentioned ethics in the State of the State, but the way in which he mentioned it was almost like, oh, yeah, and here's a list of stuff. Oh, yeah, these ethical things will happen, and then maybe, okay, great, and then let's move on. And then he has almost not touched it at all since then.
Yeah, I'm sorry, but we only have a minute, and I wanted to ask you real quickly, who's behind Andrew? If Andrew runs for president, is it Schneiderman who's up next? Almost governor, AG?
Yeah, I mean, I think I think Eric would probably have a pretty decent resume. You know, the attorney general has always been a job that has kind of given rise to kind of gubernatorial ambitions. It's kind of an executive position. It lets you make a lot of headlines. You know, I quite frankly think that Andrew Cuomo is going to run for re-election and probably not have too hard of a time of it. Next year, you know, the question will become, if he does decide to look higher, who would be the next in line? You know, I think that's a long way down the road. So
well, it is. And it's a great thrill for me to have Jesse McKinley of The New York Times on with us this week. Jesse, I can't say that I disagree with much of what you've said here today. If I did, I would fight with you. But since I agree with you, I'll just shut up. In any case, it's great to have you on the Capital Connection, and we thank you for joining us.
Terrific. Anytime, Alan.
Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.